kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
Scared. That didn't sound like her. I think that it was someone else that did that. I think that was an imposter.
Oh, was that the cry for help that we talked about the other week?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Something's wrong.
Like, no, she usually goes, That was like, I don't know.
All right, I'm calling 911.
You only got to call 911 if I say I don't like the division.
Okay, she's fine.
Ori was a shit game, and you're like, shit!
Oh, God. Something's really wrong now.
What? I don't like Dr. Pepper.
I can't wait to buy a PS5. What the fuck?
Damn.
I'm feeling particularly well rested.
Yeah.
I guess that's actually me now too, so go figure. But that, I'm not sure.
You and your 8 hours of sleep though, that's, you know,
that's banana bread.
Yeah.
That's banana bread.
Oh, everything's great because banana bread. I can't believe you thought banana bread would help. God, that's one of my favorite Simpsons jokes. I baked you banana bread. But oh my god. It's getting hookabook over here. I'm actually finally trying to start using the basement stuff, the workout stuff, because COVID is getting to that point where I'm like, I don't want to go to the gym. But it's just in time that I bought a big bench. But working out in your basement isn't as cool as getting in your car and wasting gas.
I'm just pretending in my mind that when you're like, I got a big bench, I'm just imagining a big park bench in your basement.
Oh, sometimes I'll work out
to sleep on it.
I'll just go in there and sit and just throw breadcrumbs onto the floor. I just make believe there are some geese in the basement. Yeah, I know that's not correct English. That was the joke. Don't catch me, folks. It's like I'm hoping to get use out of that thing. Have you ever had that experience before where you feel like it's easier to do something when you're not at home than when you're at home with the exact same tools to do it?
No, because I'm two steps above being a hermit.
Oh, well, there you go. Well,
I don't want to do anything outside of the home. That sounds awful.
Have you ever had any trouble doing anything outside the house that you have it's easier for you to do at home, Cole?
Literally everything.
You gotta admit, though, if that is about you end up becoming naturally, like, it's not forced on you, it's not a bad way to be. You're like, well, I like waking up, going downstairs, sit down, play the game, or reading a book, gotta pee, go to the bathroom, sit down again. Eat a sandwich, sit there. Like, you don't have to do anything. Whereas people who are like, I need to go out all the time, you're like, shit, I got nowhere to go. I got to make up some place to go. So they just like throw a stick across the street. I'm going to go pick up that stick.
That's my husband. And that is really exhausting to live with for 20 years.
Go places, have a destination.
He always has somewhere to be, something to do, someone to talk to. And I'm like, sit the fuck down.
Just sit here and look at this paint with me. All I'm saying. Stare down the paint. And oh my god, I didn't realize this game was coming to the Switch. You gotta be freaking kidding me. I've been making fun of this Joker for a while now. Game where all the women are boats.
Yes. Azur Lane. Crosswave.
It's like, why are there women boats? Like, they're just like,
there's
little like ships.
There's deep lore in the anime.
Yeah, sure.
Man, this has the potential to be up there with like Tokyo Tattoo Girls. Maybe, I don't know. I might see myself Buddhist, like, why the fuck does this exist? Who sat down and said boats but women?
I think that I, because
you I think you reviewed the expansion, didn't you?
Yeah, I beat the whole game and reviewed the DLC, which most of which I also beat, and I also started watching the anime.
Shit! So,
Chip!
Boats is a mechanic that works somehow.
I feel like this should all be on the show.
You can turn on the recorder anytime.
The opening stuff for the hell of it, just in case, unless your hard drive's that close to full, you just record it anyway.
I need to have the intro.
You know the intro too. You got an editor, snip and push, and shit.
Move now it you're in asking the too much.
Yeah.
No, it's not as a period, you know, like, okay, that review was done, and then just like slap that whole conversation after the review, and then another one comes up. And that's like, that's it. Like,
so I'm just keeping this entire call and using this as the whole episode beginning, aren't I?
Sure.
All the talk of Cole being kidnapped.
Yep.
It's all going to be included.
Sure. Battery's not included. That's for sure.
Talk Patreon about your bench. Content,
baby.
She's over here.
Rip.
Rip.
Rip booty.
But anyway, I think what it is that, like, because there's so few animes that I've actually gotten into, like, I think that I'm just not super jaded about anime, so it's kind of like, if something does, like, keep my attention for a second, then I usually will, like, actually watch it, and then just be like, okay, that was the thing.
Well, I mean, you always have that anime where the people were, like, red and white blood cells.
Yeah, I started to watch that one. It didn't grab me, but I could give it a shot someday.
I like the idea of just imagining these like blood cells being represented as people hanging out in like, I don't know, Vessel Town, and then all of a sudden like a clogged artery kicks in. It's like they try to encapsulate that as like some kind of great threat they even have a chance of stopping. Like, oh my god, these fat cells just stop coming. What do we do? Like, you're fucked. What are you gonna do?
I like to think of it as a giant cultural experiment. It's like, what can't they make an anime out of? It's just a formula that is so, like, universal, almost. Like, you could just filter anything through the typical plot and, like, tropes of, you know, of an anime. So, I enjoy the fact that they really try to stretch those boundaries, you know?
I'm waiting for the anime where the board game characters are an actual character in the anime. Like, every time the board game comes out, the characters in the board game become actual live characters and they're interacting. Like, oh my god, he just rolled sticks! What am I going to do? What the fuck does the game rule tell you to do? You're going to move 6 feet? You ain't doing nothing. Just have a...
So close to that, yeah.
You may as well do it. I mean, the whole thing would just be like an episode of Yu-Gi-Oh! Except the Yu-Gi-Oh! Characters are the actual characters on the board. Like, you have this monk who has, like, these cool powers. He's like, I'm going to destroy that monster. You'll see. And then, like, the guy that's playing the board game rolls the die that determines the power. He rolls a one. And it's just like, my power! It's being sapped away! Like, he's just, like, ham it up. What all the guys are doing is just playing a simple game. But since they characterize all the pawns and pieces, it just gets over-dramatized in such a way that it'll be hysterical.
Yeah.
I'm 5 steps away from claiming the ultimate corporation. None of you can stop me. I'm going to play this chance card. No!
See? You did it. You successfully, tested a hypothesis. Can a board game be filtered through a typical anime plot, and would it work? And the answer is yes. It would work.
And oh, I would board games. This. Don't get me started on board games right now.
Yeah, I read about that.
Had a happy ending, though. If it had a bad ending, I'd be like, oh no, don't get him started on it. But now you can be like, get me started, because I have a crazy tale that ended well.
Well, it hasn't ended well yet. I've been told it will end well, but...
You think she'll flake?
I hope not. God, I hope not.
I don't think she will. If she went through all the hassle of talking to you and then determining if they were going to do it, they're not going to not do it. If anything, the real question is, will the post office fuck up twice?
Well, it's not the post office, it's UPS. So I'm even more pissed off because I paid a shitload to mail a goddamn board game because I wanted to make sure it was packaged properly and secure and handled well. And I didn't want to find a box and poorly package a board game myself and have something get fucked up.
I totally understand that. And it sucks that that's how I ended up going down too. But
which, by the way, the people who don't know the story is I sold my copy of HeroQuest, which is a good $200 board game, on Mercari, and I shipped it out via UPS to California, and I got a phone call tonight from some confused lady in New Jersey who had my board game.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's New Jersey. I mean, she's going to be confused.
Yeah. So apparently someone at the UPS store had their order placed with mine, and they put both items in the one box. So, like, my item still had the original order label attached to it.
Mm-hmm. It's such like, an odd thing, just to ship it with someone else's shipment.
Like, what the fuck? I paid $52 to mail a board game.
$52.
It was like $45 for the actual shipping services, which I don't know what all that includes. Hopefully it includes the insurance I paid for, because that was...
It has to be, because like, I'm sitting here thinking about, like, it was HeroQuest. I've seen the box. It's not that big.
No, so, it's a standard board game.
Yeah. So, like, the $45 has to be, like, insurance and, like, protective packaging and stuff, because I don't know where else the fuck you could have paid for with it.
I don't know. And then $6 for, I think, the box...
You spent more to ship that than I spent to ship Rock Band.
Yeah, and materials. How much did you drop on shipping Rock Band?
34, and that was with signature, like some tracking and signature at location.
How did you ship it? Did you just like slap a shipping label on the box and send it as is?
No, I had them wrap it. Believe it or not, they were kind enough to actually just suggest it. And I was like, oh, God, yeah. And they were like, you know, if you ship it like it is, there's no box big enough for Rock Band 4. So you'd have to, like, just ship it like this. I'm like, I don't know how I feel about this. Like, well, you could just, you know, wrap it. Because if you don't wrap it, I mean, this thing getting transferred, someone's going to steal it. I'm like, they probably fucking will. Let's just wrap this thing. So we wrapped it all the way up, something fierce, like a magic Christmas present, and I slapped the label on top of the wrapping. So, from what I could tell, it looks like it turned out pretty well. I mean, the guy got it. He was ecstatic. I was worried he was going to pull some mess. Like, you ruined my pristine box by taping a label. Oh, bitch, I kept your thing from getting stolen. Because you know someone's going to steal that shit.
Yeah. Looking back, I definitely should have just shipped the board game myself. It would have been cheaper. It would have not been in New Jersey right now.
That's going to have a tale to tell. I was going to tell you were in this creepy place called New Jersey. The people
now
there,
it has herpes. No.
Oh, herpes. New Jersey is loaded with them.
Womp, womp. Good old herpes.
I love how I'm sitting here making fun of New Jersey despite the fact that it's not far enough. It's not so far away from me that someone can just come over and like, this is what you think of New Jersey, asshole, and just like punch me in the face. Like, I got friends in New Jersey. I'll go to visit them. And like, I heard what you said about New Jersey. I'm like, yeah, but you know, I was just kidding, right, fellas? I'm just kidding.
I've been to New Jersey, so I speak from firsthand experience.
All those states are so small up there that you could spit and cross the state line anyway. So
that's the way we like it. We like spitting in other states.
Yeah, that sounds pretty accurate.
Hey, Pennsylvania is a big enough state. We're doing okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you were in central PA or something, you pretty much may as well be in just any other mega state. But if you're on the corner of the state or yeah, where I'm at.
We're not the biggest state, but we've got some girth to us. So
we're the biggest state.
Yeah.
Because Alaska don't count.
The thing about Kentucky is that, like, it's a narrow state and people don't understand how fucking wide it is. And that you can go from being in the foothills of the mountains and in 4 hours, you're on flat-ass land where the tornadoes are at.
Wait, so it's actually to the point where, like, tornadoes can... You can actually, like, say, be at a house, look out and see a tornado over the ravine, like, hitting, like, a lower plain terrain?
No, you can't see for 4 hours. That's like... It's 200 miles.
Straight, like, oh, I can just... look out into an expanse and like get see like an indication there's a tornado over there and it's fucking shit up.
We did have one tornado hit here that was like big enough to make an actual mess of things for a while. Mm-hmm. But because of the hills here, this side of the state doesn't get them very often. And when you do get one, it just fucking bounces between the hills and fucks up everything. So yeah, you could, in theory, be on top of a hill and see a tornado just like bouncing around.
It's like a pinball game.
Yeah. Because like they don't get enough momentum to go all the way up the hills because the slopes are too tall. So they just kind of like, you know, roll back and forth between the hills if they hit into a valley. But now like out on western Kentucky, over by Indiana and Illinois and stuff, like it's flatter, and they just 7-8 times a year they just get pancaked by a tornado, and it's not as common over here. Also, we're in different time zones. Western Kentucky is an hour behind us.
Really?
Yeah. I learned that the hard way when I went to go get my dog, because I was supposed to meet the lady at like 2, and I showed up at her doorstep.
I didn't realize
way early.
I didn't realize there were states that were split in time zone.
Yeah.
I always assume that if you cross a state line, that's when the time zone change would occur. So that would have to suck for sure.
But, there's definitely states that I know driving through Tennessee, you'll hit a time zone change.
That's got to be so bizarre. Like, I can just picture people.
There's towns that are split.
Yeah, there's towns that are split. That was the thing, like, when we got to her house and she was like, oh, yeah. She was like, if you were just, like, 2 streets over, you'd still be in Eastern time zone. I was like, what?
Like, I can't even imagine, like, trying to coordinate with people in the same town. Like, oh, yeah, well, if you're coming to my house, you got to turn that clock back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how about, like, oh, that's how it would be. Like, we're having a party. Okay, so whose clock are we abiding by for this party? Well, I guess we're going by your shit. I need extra time. So just for today, it's your clock. So I'm an hour behind schedule. So guess what? It's your time to start. So I'm cheating in a way.
Chris is always an hour behind Mr. Central Time Zone over there.
I just don't know how to read clocks.
I'm in the middle without a plan. I'm a boy and I'm a man.
Making up song lyrics as you go.
No, that's an Alice Cooper song.
I was singing the Alice Cooper song.
Oh, I thought you said I was making up one.
Yeah, I was singing the lyrics, making up lyrics as you go. My name's Alice Cooper, yo-ho-ho, I'm a pirate.
Oh, I didn't hear the second part.
Yeah, you know that song, the Alice Cooper, I'm a pirate song.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Alice Cooper loved pirates. It was in a documentary.
Alright, this shit's getting weird. Are you guys ready to talk about games?
Sure. Only if the games are weird.
I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay, then. Let's talk about weird games.
Potentially weird. We'll find out.
Try to make it weird. So this game, you're a spaceman. I wish you were a spaceman.
Anyway, first game to talk about is called Chronos Before the Ashes, developed by Gunfire Games, published by THQ Nordic, released December 1st on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $29.99. Chronos Before the Ashes is an atmospheric RPG that chronicles a hero's lifelong quest to save their homeland from a great evil. Grow wiser, stronger, and more powerful as you explore the depths of the mysterious labyrinth, but beware, the labyrinth takes a heavy toll. Each time your hero dies, they lose a year of their life. I guess that's better than losing your entire life?
I don't know. Depends on how you take it, because, well, I'll get into that. But, the idea behind this game, it's got a really weird plot, actually. At the beginning of the game, a witch kind of tells you this tale of a world that's being kind of controlled by a malevolent dragon. And this dragon's being guarded by a trio of giant beasties, essentially. Guardians, if you will. And your character's role is to defeat the guardians and make it, like, remove the barrier so that you can fight the dragon, defeat it, and then, you know, save the land. However, the trade-off here is that your character is sort of cursed, in that the way it is that when you're born, or not when you're born, we start the game, you're 18 years old, and you choose between whether you be a boy or a girl, and whether or not your weapon of choice to start is an axe or a sword. Both are weapons that use different stats to like buff them, to basically give them stat bonuses and using it a la Dark Souls, because I'm just going to get this out of the way right now. This game plays a lot like Dark Souls, so just here you go. So once you are pretty much selected as far as your gender and also your weapon, you are thrown out into the game. And essentially you run around and you get button choice layouts of as follows. Right bumper is your light attack. Right trigger is your heavy attack. Hold it down, charge it, and get a full swing off. Left bumper is your shield block, and left trigger is your parry. Sound familiar? It should. And then aside from that, you eventually get access to... Man, I won't go into that just yet. So, those are your primary functions of attack. As you go into the game, you're kind of at a... You start off on like a weird mechanical tower, like an old, like dilapidated lighthouse-looking thing, which makes for interesting, you know, conjectures, like what the kind of world you're inhabiting, because eventually you teleport away from that tower to, you know, a typical, you know, like... You know, Dark Ages style labyrinth where you're fighting with, again, your sword and your shield, or your axe and your shield, and you're fighting like general beasties and the like. And as you run around this labyrinth, you fight monsters who you have to kind of be smart about, because you got to pay, you know, parry slash block or whatnot. Because if you attack too much, or rather, you have a stamina gauge, so like if you try to block and they knock your guard down too much, you'll get winded and you start taking damage. But unlike a lot of games like this, attacks and your dodge roll do not take stamina. It is a very strange and unexpected thing, but hey, I still got my ass beat a couple times, so it's not an end all be all in safety. But you're basically fighting monsters here to and fro. You're hoping to find gear as you patrol the areas, though admittedly new weapons and shields are very rare in my opinion as far as this game goes. You find dragon shards, which can be used to increase the power of your weapon. And I was trying to hoard them initially, thinking, well, I'll wait till I get a better weapon, spend them all on that. And you don't find a new weapon until well after the first boss, which isn't like, he's not like 30 minutes away. He's like a couple, like a good hour or two away from you. But you don't get a new weapon until well after him. So eventually to beat him, I did have to ultimately spend some gear, spend dragon shards to just upgrade the base weapon. That's how rare new weapons and gear are. Damn. Now, when you eventually kill enough dudes to level up, you have four stats: strength, agility, arcane, and vitality. You can spend your attribute points to level those things up. Now, time to talk about the weirdness of this game and what makes it a little bit more unique. So, attribute points at the beginning of the game. You get about two or three, I think it's like somewhere between two and four per level. And it costs 1 point to level up strength and agility, and are also vitality, but it costs 3 points to level up your arcane, which is kind of freaking busted. However, the reason for that is because every time you die, your character spawns back, just like a typical game like this, like Dark Souls and such. But when you spawn back, you grow, you age 1 year. In my opinion, for a lot of people, that's a cool concept. For me, it was like, way to give me an instant death counter, jerk game. Frustrated the shit out of me. It's like, crap, I'm how old? That's how many times I've died. Nuts. But you come back, you're 1 year older, and over time your character does start to look a little different. Gameplay wise, though, your character performs about the same. That element doesn't change. However, the things that do change are as follows. As you get to a certain age in the game, those stat points and the points that are required to upgrade them change around a bit. Like, it becomes harder and eventually impossible, most likely, to level up strength and agility. Arcane starts to become cheaper to level up. So my main thought when I was playing the game is that you want to just almost ignore arcane early on, because you get more bang for your buck spending 1 point on your agility and your strength. And then once you get to the point where you're too old to level those things up, you start dumping all your points in arcane. In addition to that, every 10 years of life, you get access to a new trait. You get to choose between three different traits that's available at that spot, and you take the one that's going to ultimately go with you throughout the rest of your life. So you're kind of building your character as you go and hoping that you're making the right choices for them based on your aged trait gains. So honestly, I kind of like that element, though, at least for the first two, I kind of personally felt like it was an obvious choice. Just like, I'm going to take this because it just makes sense. For example, one of them, because it's early enough, so I don't think it's a spoiler, it's like the first one you get. You can choose between like increased health increased strength, or increased experience points on kills. What do you think makes the most sense to take? Especially because healing yourself is a little rough in this game, too. Whereas Dark Souls has Estus Flask, this game has Dragon Stones. However, you start with no Dragon Stones. Each time you find one in a labyrinth, it's kind of treated like a decent-sized item, like a heart container in Zelda. And as you pick those up, that ends up being one time you can use it to get a full heal. When you use it, you don't get it back, as in it is gone, gone. So the only ways you can heal your character is to use a Dragon Stone or to level up. And if you level up, you get a full heal. But if you die, the Dragon Stones that get used, they get refilled at least. So if you found two or three Dragon Stones and then you die, you'll come back with two or three new Dragon Stones. But when I said they're gone, gone, I said that to mean that you need to be smart about your life, because as you're running around fighting dudes, you can't just like say, use both Dragon Stones, go back to a teleportation World Stone and refill them. Because yeah, you can teleport around once you find World Stones, but you don't regain health, you don't regain your Dragon Stones, you don't regain anything. So it's like, fuck you, guy. Good luck. There's also a sort of magic element in the game, but I kind of was kind of in about it. And it comes in the form of these like Dragon Stones. What they are is Dragon Eyes. You find them as you run around the levels, and they come in the form of various elements. While you have one equipped, whenever you do attack damage, you start to kind of build up a little gauge. And in addition to that, every time you do like a charged, like heavy attack, you will also use the power of that stone to kind of imbue your weapon with the element of the eye. Once you max that actual bar out, however, you can press the X button to kind of activate the stone's power, but it's usually nothing more than the equivalent of like a buff to your character's weapon or a little buff to your character's defense that goes beyond just doing the heavy strike. So while you will use it because you'll want it to get the upper hand on occasional battles, it doesn't have the oomph of throwing a fireball or, you know, like ice shards or anything like that. So I kind of feel like, I don't want to say drop the ball or anything, but it doesn't have a lot of oomph and like pizzazz there. So I kind of mostly ignored it and just used it as like a general utility. So aside from that, you're basically running around the labyrinth. Every once in a while you find items you need to use for puzzles. You might need to merge them together sometimes to make a new item and then activate a puzzle. But there are some puzzles that are just kind of like running around, take this item, put it here to open this door, to open that door with this item. But there's other things which are pretty cool that kind of tweak the, like, you know, the visuals. For example, like again, early in the game, I like talking about that because I feel like it's early enough that you'll see it and won't spoil you. But you start going to like these mirrors by activating runes, and you think initially that, oh, I'm just teleporting from room to room. Okay, that's nifty, I guess. But what ends up happening eventually is you end up teleporting onto a bookshelf. So not only do you teleport to a new location, but you also shrink and you're running around on a bookshelf looking for a key that you're too small to pick up. And you also find mirrors that make you grow so you can fight giants and stuff like that. And I thought that was a pretty cool little thing to do with that mechanic. Honestly, I personally feel as though this game is a solid sense of fun. It has a bit of a good mystery to it, as in like why you are. I mean, because again, they tell you the story about there being a dragon and what you're trying to do, but they don't really lay out the idea of like, why am I on this? Why am I on this island? Or like a lighthouse with like mechanics, like, you know, mechanical tools and stuff like that. And then I'm teleporting to these weird labyrinths that have nothing to do with technology. I don't understand what's going on here. It gives you a nice little mystery to work up to. And also, though it's not exactly complicated with like deep customization and equipment and gear, it is like kind of like a lightish form of it where you're kind of going in, you're not overwhelmed with equipment options. You get a few new things, but you're not going to sit there and go, crap, I have this sword, but I have these five swords. I could upgrade one or the other. I don't know. No, you just choose an axe or a sword or whatever you get and just roll with it. Who cares? Just have fun. But I do feel like, though I think it was also the intent of the game, I personally find myself every time I die, I'm like, shit, I even tried to reset the game once when it's just like, no, stop. And I came back, the game's like, oh no, you dose sucker, you died. And we remember that. So don't be surprised if you find yourself going, I died too many times trying to figure out how to beat this boss. So I am in turn going to start the whole fucking game over and hopefully do better this time. Or you might go to the point where you end up getting letting yourself just get to like age 50 and just run around with all your perks and just start mashing the entire game up. I don't know. You do you, bro. But in the end, I think the game does do a decent job at what it's trying to do. It's a fun title. It captures that element of like looking around to find new stuff. Every time you see a new enemy, I got to figure out what his movement patterns are and determine how to block his guard or get around him or whatever. It carries that well. And I didn't find myself feeling bored and I didn't find myself going, ugh, it's like Dark Souls, but no, I just had fun playing. It's a good time.
Well, then for $30, what is your verdict?
I think it's a buy.
That works for me because I bought it.
Uh-oh. Well, now you better tell me. You better message me later. Go, this is the best game ever, Pernell. Thanks for telling me to buy it.
I have not played it yet. I am looking forward to playing it, but I did buy it when it was on pre-order for $23.99.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will admit some of those starter sales are a nice little treat to make you go, yeah, I need to get it now while the getting's good.
I'd love those launch sales.
Mm-hmm. Everyone should do it. Everyone.
Agreed. Everybody, make your games cheaper. Anyway, next game is called Shiren the Wanderer, the Tower of Fortune, and the Dice of Fate, developed and published by Spike Chunsoft, released December 2nd on Steam for $19.99. The classic roguelike wanders on to Steam. Adventure with the Wanderer and his sidekick Kappa the Talking Ferret through a world filled with cunning monsters, deadly traps, and countless treasure. Chris, tell us about this one.
Cunning monsters. I don't know. Like, their difficulty is in numbers, I think, not cleverness.
I don't know, man.
Yeah? Are there good strategizers in this game?
Not so much strategizers, but they're cunning enough in a sense where I can still find myself being like, fuck, that guy's trying to flank me off. He doesn't want me to get to the stairs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They do crowd you. That's very true. Okay, so Shiren the Wanderer. Well, this is, of course, the fifth game, I believe, in a series of roguelikes that are kind of like, I'm not going to say the original roguelike, that would be Rogue, but, you know, like a specific style of roguelike that I really, really enjoy. People may know it. This is like the most popular kind, really, because people will know it from the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games, the Chocobo Dungeon games, and maybe a little more obscure, the Tornico's Quest, like Dragon Quest style roguelike games. So this is like the game that kind of started that grand tradition of the kind of, I don't even know what you would call it, like the Mystery Dungeon style, I guess.
The rectangular room that's connected by a narrow corridor.
Yes, which actually I recently, like that's the way they construct dungeons in Lufia 3. And I just recently beat Lufia 3, so yeah, I'm very, very familiar with rectangular rooms connected with tunnels. So yeah, in this particular game, I believe started life on the DS, and then, you know, only in Japan about 10 years ago, and has come over here once or twice, definitely on the Vita, which I think Pernell has played through. And now it's, yeah, on Steam and on Switch, which is great, because the last time a Shiren game came out on a Nintendo system was the Wii game many, many years ago, which I have as well. So, shocking. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Shiren. So, yeah, this is a, you know, for lack of a better word, I guess, it's the newest game in the series. Where he basically has to, our hero Shiren and his little ferret friend, who, the Kappa, I guess, I actually had forgotten the name until the intro just now. they have to climb a series of towers in order to, I guess, roll the dice and face off against, some kind of god or something like that. You know how it goes. That's not really the point. The point is that you have to go into a bunch of little dungeons between towns and try your best to survive. Will you survive? No, you will get killed many times because these games, they start difficult and then get difficult from there. But that's the charm of it is the, you know, kind of the strategizing that you can do in this. And usually in Shiren games, there's also a little bit of an overarching growth that one can enjoy. I especially liked in the first game how there would be partners that you could come across in the dungeons randomly and have them join up with you. And they actually kind of grow as you go in subsequent adventures. That's missing from this one, but everything else is there. So you basically, you start a dungeon with whatever your loadout is. Now, although you initially, through the tutorials, of which there are many, there's a ton of tutorials in this game. You will be an expert by the time you get into the first dungeon, just letting you know. And that's fine, because it does have a unique way of playing. So it's good that the game, like, really thoroughly not only has you play example dungeons for each tutorial, but reward you with an actual item. So you can, like, actually build a really good first loadout, you know, from there. And, yeah, eventually you come across a place where you can store said items, which is very important. If you survive a dungeon, then you're able to keep the items that you found in that dungeon and then take them to a place and store them. And those will become, like, your loadouts for future trips. Now, here's the thing about this game, and this is true of all roguelikes, but it's especially heartbreaking in Shiren. Things can break, you know, items can break, items burn up, items can be taken away from you by traps, they can be stolen from you, and, you know, you just cannot hang on to any sort of sense of permanence, even though you're allowed to, like, really strategize in these games. You know, if you have a really great item, then don't, you know, you can either keep it in storage forever or you can use it and lose it. So that's the name of the game. So, you know, you can equip, like, all kinds of weapons, shields, scrolls, you know, rocks, sticks and stones, you know, whatnot, arrows, of course, which, again, there's a tutorial for each one of those things. The way that the dungeons actually play is a turn-based system where the enemy does not move unless you move. And so you have lots and lots of time to do things like, you know, of course, check out the enemy, see how much of a threat they are, you know, assess the threat and face your character in the right direction. That's extremely important. And, you know, either use or, like, change your weapon or your approach or something like that. And so it's a very strategic game. It's not very fast paced. It can be, but if you try to play the game too quickly, then you will die too quickly. So therefore, because not only can the monsters, like, well, not necessarily outwit, but they can certainly outnumber you very quickly. Then, you know, there's also traps. They can lay traps. There's traps in the dungeon. There's ways to deal with the traps, and you are expected to learn how to deal with traps. But yeah, you know, it's danger at every turn. And so it's all about, like, strategizing and, you know, building up those items and stuff like that. And yeah, that's the overarching thing about Shiren. So in this new chapter, I noticed, versus the other ones I've played, a little more personality to this one. There's a lot more people to talk to. There's a kind of overarching story that's going on, as well as, you know, it's not just climbing these towers. There's a little bit more of a purpose. You know, there's a lot more characters to meet. And of course, there's shops and, like, you know, ways to improve your items, a really healthy crafting system, and even gambling, which I love. And so, yeah, this one will really keep you busy. But I think the dungeons are maybe a little shorter than other chapters. So it's kind of like, which is, you know, fine if you're not wanting to, like, delve into, you know, like in the original game. The original game just goes on for, like, forever, because I think it's, like,
I can help you with this part. This,
oh, yeah.
Oh, God. No, this game is not short.
It's not. Okay.
They sucker punch you. I agree with you. Like, early on, you think it's fairly short. It's like, like it says, the three towers. And yeah, then they add a tower after that, which is like the super tower. Like, basically, now I'm at the Tower of Fortune. And after that, there's another tower that you have to climb. Keep in mind, all this has to be done in pretty much one shot. Like, to do it right. But then after you beat the game, which, good fucking luck, once you beat the game, there's a absurd number of bonus dungeons. And they all, like, tweak the formula in a way that it makes the main game look kind of like a joke. In the sense of, like, for example, like, early, like, when you play this one, I would say it's the most probably beginner-friendly, because early on, like, you find items, it's like, okay, I have the steel sword, this is cool, and I have the rubber shield, this is great. And then, like, eventually you start getting to the point where it's like, you have question mark, and this pot is question mark, and this scroll is question mark, and everything is unknown. So you might eat grass that kills you right then and there.
Like, yeah, I played that far into the first game for sure.
It fucks you with sleep big time. It gets really mean. Like, and then some of the bonus dungeons, like, they take your friends away. They make it so that you can't bring any of your built equipment in with you, so you have to start from scratch every time. Levels where, like, the lights turn off. It's a mess.
That's awesome. Yeah, I didn't play that far, so this is good to know.
You'll love it.
Nice. Oh, no, yeah, I'm really looking forward to all this.
Pulls the old switcheroo.
The switcheroo. If only we were reviewing the Switch version. And it would be a Switch review.
Switcheroony.
Fernell mentioned bonus dungeons. I'm reading that for the Steam and I guess the Switch version, 3 new bonus dungeons were added that will challenge even the most experienced wanderer. There is a music collection so you can enjoy your favorite tracks from the series history. And I know at least on Steam, there's an audience live display mode optimized for streaming gameplay.
Yeah.
This would be a pretty interesting game to stream.
And another new addition is that if you lose your character, you can basically put out like a help me, and anybody who's playing this game online can actually go into the dungeon and save you.
That is cool.
Yeah, I haven't had the chance to test that out, but it's a really cool thing. And the Vita had that, but it only had the ad hoc, you know, multiplayer. So this is actually like global. So
nice.
I like that addition.
The Vita too. It was.
Was it global? Okay.
Yeah, I only know it because like I had a buddy in Virginia who, when he got to the point where he was honestly better than I was at the game, he was like, "Are you at this dungeon yet?" I'm like, "Not yet." Like, "Shit, come save me! I'll wait. Just catch up so you can come save me."
My like, source lied to me.
I don't think it was a lot of people that talked about it on the Vita because I feel like it was fairly niche on there though.
I can't remember. I came across this one at some point and I wanted to buy it, but I think I didn't have a Vita at the time, so I didn't, and now I wish I did.
But now you got a better version of it.
Yeah, I know, exactly. And I'm actually going to buy the Switch version too. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so I'm guessing that's your official verdict?
Yeah, for $20. It's $20 on Steam too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely worth it. It's great if you're trying to get into the Mystery Dungeon series and you want to learn all about it and be challenged like left and right. And it sounds like at the end, all in all directions. And I just love Sheeran. It's full of charm. It's got beautiful graphics is what I was going to get to next, but that's okay. And I just really, I like the flow of these games. Like I really like the whole idea of kind of building your own loadout and just the risk and reward. And, you know, it's even better because it's like kind of wrapped up in this sort of, you know, gambling facade as well. So, and it sounds like there's just tons and tons and tons of content. So, I mean, for $20, how could you deny it? I would say buy it.
Sounds good. Pernell, do you remember what it launched at on the Vita? How much it was?
It was definitely 40. And was then it 40? You pay 60 to get the boxed edition of it with like all the goodies and stuff.
So $20 is a nice little bargain.
I would say so. You'll get more from this game than most other games on this console, hands freaking down. I put over 100 hours into it and barely touched it.
Nice.
Damn. Anyway, next game is called Family Mysteries 2 Echoes of Tomorrow, developed by Brave Giant, published by Artifex Mundi, released October 30th on Xbox One for $14.99. Frame scientist travels through time to save his beloved wife and reveal kidnapper's identity, find hidden objects in the post-apocalyptic world, solve cyberpunk puzzles, and embrace the future full of adventures. Cole, tell us about Family Mysteries 2 Echoes of Tomorrow.
Man. Let me be honest here. I have certain expectations when it comes to an Artifex Mundi published title. And the primary one of those expectations is that I get a strong female protagonist. They've been letting me down lately. and they're introducing more male protagonists, and Family Mysteries has a male protagonist. And I was like, damn it!
Well, again, this one's developed by Brave Giant, so it's not like they Artifacts.
I did say published by.
True.
For the record. But Brave Giant has been behind the majority of the Artifacts Monday releases recently to consoles. And they are a little more willing to, like, not necessarily break the Artifacts Monday mold, but they bend it a little. They do their best. I will give them bonus points. Normally, when I have an Artifacts Monday game, we all know how much I love them. Nobody's surprised that's ever heard this podcast is going to be like, oh, she likes those. No, everybody knows I love them. But I do typically give them some grief for how poorly the face animations look.
Mm-hmm.
Still images in every game published by Artifacts Monday are always beautiful. They're really well rendered. They're really well just illustrated in every way. They're pretty. But the facial animations in particular for the characters are always a little off. And I am proud to say, despite my grievances with the male protagonists, the facial animations in Family Mysteries 2 are some of the best that I've seen in any Artifacts Monday game.
Hmm.
I'll give them bonus points. They're getting better. Unfortunately, there were a couple of other instances where the animation kind of just like took a nosedive. One in particular is like there's a sequence where your character's like crawling through these tunnels. I suspect that on mobile and or Steam, this particular sequence is like a mini game and you're supposed to trail the puzzle paths. And for whatever reason, they opted not to do that on console. That's my theory. Because it looks very much like it was meant to be you guide the character through these paths. But instead, you just watch as like this stationary top-down view of a dude on his hands and knees moves along this snaky trail in the most jankily way possible. I don't know what the point of that whole little sequence was beyond it was supposed to be a mini game that we just don't get.
Maybe.
It was so odd. And it was really one of the few times where I was just kind of like pulled out of the game and like, what? There was another mini game where it was a legit mini game. Where you need to guide the character on a grid. We've seen this kind of puzzle in other Artifacts Monday games, especially Big Giant. They like to do these a lot, where you have some kind of enemy like moving about on a grid, and you need to navigate around them, and they move when you move, kind of thing. The animation and the character model and everything for that particular puzzle, not good. And it was kind of a surprise, given that we've seen these types of puzzles from them before, and they did so well everywhere else that it was odd that these two sequences in particular stood out like sore thumbs. Again, with the way that this particular dev team likes to bend that Artifacts Monday mold, they actually did a sci-fi narrative for this particular game. It was a little jarring at first because I'm so used to these games having like some kind of fantasy concept that being thrown into a sci-fi world, I was like, what the hell is going on? Why is everything cyberpunky? It was really kind of awkward to adjust to because it just wasn't what I was expecting when I think Artifacts. They did a good job with it. I'm not a huge sci-fi fan, but I think for what they did, it was fine. There's some time travel aspects. There's some weird quirks to the story that I can't really talk about without giving away like major plot points. But you really gotta like accept the suspension of disbelief for this one. It's I don't know why, but the unicorns and some of the other ones in the flying dragon seem far more plausible than the time travel shit. But also, I just generally don't like time travel shit. So maybe that's why it set a little more off with me. But it took a little bit of getting used to. There are some other quirks in the writing. You can definitely tell this is written by the same teams that write the strong independent female characters, because some of the dialogue definitely doesn't sound like shit men say. There was just a lot of nuance and stuff to the character that you were like, oh yeah, it's a dude this time. And it was kind of awkward. Not necessarily bad, just awkward. And it felt kind of off. The puzzles are a lot of things that we've seen before, not anything really shaking any of it up. Most of them you're going to know how to, if you've played any other one of these games at all, you're going to know how to solve it just by looking at it. I will say that family mysteries felt a little more like they were trying to hand fist in more puzzles. Like they would literally have a bit of dialogue and then, oh, you have to do this puzzle before he gives you the next bit of dialogue. And I'm going, no, just tell me what's happening and let me go. it was just a little off because it was a little different from what I expected, but it's not necessarily bad. I think it's an okay Artifacts Monday game for what it is. I definitely give them credit on the improvements that they've made, but I wouldn't say that this would be the first one I would tell somebody to check out if they hadn't checked out another Artifacts Monday game before.
No. Well, overall, $15, your verdict?
I still think at $15, it's a buy it. The puzzles are solid. It's just that for some reason, this one felt more like they were just like, oh yeah, puzzle, here, have one. So, I mean, if the puzzle aspect is what you enjoy more than the hidden object part, then you're going to be like, fuck yeah, puzzles. Otherwise, I was sitting there wishing for more hidden object elements.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
But I do love the X-Men games, and I was not.
Yeah, I figured you couldn't go wrong with it.
Yeah, so. It's one of those, like, even when they change it, you're like, eh, okay. And you just go, keep going. Keep finding them objects.
And at least they're trying something different with sci-fi.
And they are, and you have to give them credit for that. Like, even if that's not my preferred genre of narrative, it doesn't mean it's a bad one automatically. Yeah. It's different, and it's just, at least there's more variety for people who want to jump in who don't like the scary shit like Nightmares from the Deep and Dark Carnival that I like. There's something for somebody else.
Yeah. And speaking of things for somebody else, next game to talk about is Sam and Max Save the World Remastered, developed and published by Skunk Ape Games, released December 2nd on Switch and PC for $19.99. Sam is a 6-foot canine detective with a love of justice. Max is a hyperkinetic, rabbity thing with a taste for mayhem. Together, they're the freelance police, and they're about to save the world. The freelance police are back in a remastered version of their first season of the episodic adventure games, lovingly updated by a small group of the original developers with the blessing of Sam and Max creator Steve Purcell. Chris, tell us about Sam and Max Save the World Remastered.
Okay, well, I don't know. How popular is Sam and Max? Like, do you know?
Nowadays, I don't know. Like, they used to be pretty big, but these days it seems like they're...
Cartoon or Fox.
Yeah, like, that many years ago, though, right? I don't know. Like, I knew about... Well, it seemed like I'd heard about a lot of... God dang it. It seems that I heard a lot about them. Around the time that the Wii game came out, which, you know, again, they originally, like, started releasing the games as, like, episodes, but then I think they changed their mind on that. And, yeah, this is a collection of those games that are, you know, from about, I think it was 2006 to 2007 or so. So, like, the Wii, Xbox 360 era, they had these games out. And, like, so this is, like... the full collection that has been out already, but, you know, they have remastered it by kind of like making it more HD looking, making the character models look a little bit better. and doing some other things, changing some other things, which I'll get to in a minute. So the way Sam and Max plays out is that, yeah, it's a dog and rabbit team that are thoroughly in, like, so it's kind of a Dragnet parody, right? So you've got your straight-laced, you know, Man Friday, you know, the just the facts kind of like really impassive kind of dog guy. And then you've got the loose cannon, who is so thoroughly from like straight up Hot Topic from 15 years ago. Like when I was playing this, his sense of humor like literally made me nostalgic for like 2005 humor or lack thereof. It was like that kind of thing that every webcomic and cartoon show did, where like the way that you made a joke is that you took a thing, anything, and respond to it with like violence or references to violence. Like that's it. That's all. So you've got that character running around, but you play as Sam, and it is a point and click, but kind of without the pointing and clicking. It's more like walking and talking. So, yeah, it takes place in, like I said, it's six episodes, I believe. And is it six episodes? I should probably know this.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw the list of them. Okay, cool. I got the list now. I'm bad at remembering the titles, and the titles are so good. So it's, you know, six chapters that are all independent stories, although they are kind of like loosely connected with a theme of, you know, people are being hypnotized, and usually that serves as the antagonist for any kind of situation they run into. First chapter being like some child actor, like kind of characters are like being hypnotized to like cause various annoyances around town, and you know go to different locations where there is one of them and like try to deal with it in a point and click puzzle game sort of way. It's a LucasArts product, so it's or at least it has been before. I mean, it's, yeah, I think this one, yeah, this one's Telltale, sorry. The original like Sam and Max game, which is referred to, by the way, in this game, in like the intro, is was a LucasArts game. So that's like how far back these characters go, like the early 90s. And so yeah, you walk around in different, you know, set pieces and such, like familiar to fans of the show and webcomic and print comic and other video game. And you know, try to deal with the situations by, you know, getting basically pointing at every, or like you have a cursor that you can kind of use. Not a cursor. Like when you walk into proximity of like things that are clues, then you can tap on them or scroll through with the directional pad and like kind of, you know, pick through each one and see what like is an item that you can use or something that you can do that will help you solve the puzzle. And the puzzles, of course, are very absurd. But, you know, that's the whole idea of like these kind of games in general, and especially like this one. So, again, it is the same game that has been released before. Like I said, it looks better, it sounds better. And here's my favorite part. They, whoever came up with the remaster for this game, went through all of the dialogue and like all of the jokes and stuff like that with a fine-tooth comb and actually changed and or removed things that would not fly in 2020 that did fly back in the 2005-2006 Hot Topic culture of yesteryear.
Yeah.
So, and what I like about it is it's making the internet mad. Oh, the boys are so mad about this game.
Fuck yeah. Get mad.
For doing things like removing, again, problematic content. They recast the character of Bosco, who is a black man, and they recast his voice actor from being a white dude to being an actual black man. So, yeah, that's a good thing. That's a thing that they should have done. And by the way, Bosco is great in this game. So, because he is a black man being voiced by a black man. That's great. I can't believe that this is a thing that...
How it should be.
Yeah, exactly. It's how it should have been, but, you know, we only just figured... I'm sorry? Oh.
I was saying, I'll drink to that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, that's the thing that I think really has only started happening within like a year and a half like ago, I think, with the Simpsons whole thing. So yeah, they took some really good steps, some responsible steps to make this a game that's still funny. Again, if you enjoy the type of humor where, well, for one thing, Sam is hilarious. He is very deadpan and like he makes a lot of great jokes. And I just love how casually he just accepts like everything that happens and responds to it. You know, he's, you know, like he's not, burdened by, you know, the other characters and stuff. He just kind of goes with the flow. And then again, Max is just absolutely like one of those bunnies from like the t-shirts that they sold in Hot Topic, you know, just like cute, but talking about violence. And, you know, again, that's nostalgic to me now because that's a very old thing. So yeah, all of that is retained, but now the game actually can be played and recommended for a modern audience. So yeah.
Cool. So overall $20, your thoughts?
I think this is the only version of this game that you should buy. So if you're a fan of point and clicks, it's very breezy. It's, got some like, it's got some pretty cool puzzles in it. I especially like how, because these are like inept cops, like basically they're freelance police is what the thing is. So they need to get $10,000 to buy a tear gas launcher. And, the way that they do that is to get in the car and like you can drive around in the car, in a kind of like, it's like an auto runner type of thing. And you can shoot out the taillight of another car and then pull them over and then extort them for $10,000 for driving with a broken taillight. Things like that. I just love it. So yeah, like it's got great puzzles like that. And it's got, yeah, and they're woven into the humor. So I think this is a great point and click. And I think that, just based on what they've done to improve this game alone makes it a worthwhile purchase for people who enjoy this or enjoy wackiness.
Awesome. Works for me.
Yeah.
All right. Next game is Steampunk Tower 2, developed by Dreamgate, published by Dragius Games, released December 4th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $9.99. Steampunk Tower 2 is an action strategy game set in the alternative steampunk universe. In Lord Bingham's military service, there's a new secret weapon under your command, the gigantic aircraft carrier transporting the Battle Tower. Purnell, tell us about Steampunk Tower 2.
Okay, so this is essentially a tower defense game, but unlike most tower defense games where you're given a map and you have to set up the towers all along the map to prevent the payload from being delivered to the destination. In the case of this game, you control the payload, you control the destination being a giant tower that just drops from the sky, impales the ground, and then rises up and reveals guns. How many guns? Up to 8. And the idea behind this is that when you go to a stage, you have as many bays on the tower as you've unlocked. You start out with 4, and you can equip those tower bays with a variety of different types of guns that you unlock as you play the game. You have heavy artillery, you have like, you know, sort of light guns, you have splash damage, like cannon type guns, saw blasters, electrical firing guns, and more.
And by the way, it's 10 guns, not 8.
Crap.
Yeah, you could get 5 tiers.
How do I? Maybe it's because I'm too stingy. I didn't want to buy more.
You cheap bitch.
So, I'm really cheap. So the idea is that when you go onto a stage and you equip the tower with these respective guns, they all work in different ways. Like some guns can attack ground units. I rephrase that before I go into that. Enemies will come in from both sides of the screen, the left and the right, depending on the wave. Sometimes they'll come in from both simultaneously, and enemies can either be airborne or ground-based. The guns that you use can either attack air, ground, or both, and it is also based on what area of the tower is placed at, because if you fire a gun, it has a certain firing range that it can go. But if it's higher up on the tower, this is what I gather. I'm hoping this is what actually happens, because they don't explain it. It just seemed like it. But I believe the higher up the tower a gun is, the farther the range is, because it can kind of like arc the bullet, so to speak, if it need be. But essentially, the gunfire will be used to like kind of automatically attack enemies that are coming into range of the tower. Or not automatically, I'm sorry. You go and switch to the gun. No, it is. It's automatically normal. It automatically will fire at the enemies as they're approaching the tower. However, every gun has its own amount of ammo that's attributed to it as well. And when it runs out of ammo, it's going to stop firing. There are two ways to reload ammo on a gun. You can either just hope that no one's coming towards it for that wave and let it sit out and it'll slowly build up, or you can retract the gun into the tower and let it regenerate health, ammo that much quicker. It's almost like an actual reload function when it's inside the tower. Now, another element to this game that I think is really, really cool is that the guns aren't stationary. So not only can you bring a gun into the tower just to reload it, but you can bring a gun into the tower to move it up and down and left and right on the tower. You can move the guns and place them however you need. But here's where it gets funny. Enemies will be coming at you in crazy waves. It starts out seeming like it's pretty easy to manage, but eventually starts to become pretty frantic. And as you're trying to switch guns between the left and the right sides of the tower to make them work to the best of your ability, you have to make sure that there's an actual clear pass in the tower to move the gun into range to swap them out.
So it's like a sliding block puzzle mixed with tower defense.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually really cool. Like, I actually very much enjoy the idea, like, crap, move these guys around, move these guys around. And the other part of it is, like, you would think there's not a whole lot of actual work for the player to do because, again, you're not running around a map trying to ascertain various tower situations. But you'd be wrong because in addition to moving the guns between different points in the tower and bringing the guns in to reload them, you also have each gun equipped with a special attack, which builds up as a gun fires and takes out targets. And when that is actually done and ready to fire, you can scroll over to that gun and actually unleash its special attack, usually used when you're really getting overwhelmed and you want to take care of some business. Though, in addition to that, there's also a few other perks and treats that you can unlock as you play the game to further boost your attacking potential, including the Steam Eye, which is a steam generation, because, you know, it can't be a steampunk game without steam, right? between each wave, you have time where you can rearrange your guns and reload them or whatever. But if you choose to just go right into the next wave, the sooner you jump into the wave, the more steam you'll build up. And when you reach a certain point on the steam accumulator, you can use the steam eye, which is just a huge laser that sprays the map that you can control to just, like, wipe out targets for a certain period of time. It's very freaking useful. And there's, like, artillery, which you can use a limited spurt to just kind of, like, blast a wave of bullets a la, like, Streets of Rage 1 special attacks. It's genuinely a lot of fun. When you're not in battle, there's not a ton you're going to really be doing, but there's a base that you can work with where you take money that you accrue either from winning battles or from generating it at different spots on the base itself. You use that money, you can get that money, you can use like crystals, which also is generated from battles. I'm not sure so much on the base, but definitely in battles. And you can use that to upgrade your different guns, upgrade the actual facilities within the base to do more things for you, and just build new facilities as those spots become available to you. You can then also earn junk. I just call it junk. They call it like materia or something, a word that didn't seem to click for me. Detail. They call it details. I don't know what that is. It's junk. You earn junk as you win battles. And for each gun you've constructed, you can spend junk to raise it to a certain point on like a experience point tracker. And at certain intervals, you can then spend money and crystals to add properties such as like increased firing distance or more power behind your shots or more ammo, things like that, to kind of make each gun slightly a little bit more unique. Or you can just make every gun exactly the same if you find a build for a gun that's just perfect and work with that. But one thing I also kind of liked about this that a lot of tower defense games don't do is in between normal games missions, you can also take on special missions sometimes, and they have a variety of different functions. Some special missions are cases where you need to just survive as long as possible. You might have some where you have to survive or win under specific conditions. But whatever happens, when you win these things, you can either get extra rewards for building up your base and your guns, or sometimes you'll earn brand new guns that are unique and cannot be purchased in any other way. So whereas you might want to use the Wasp because you think it's awesome and you want to construct it and build up like five of them, you can only have one Auger. So you better make that bad boy count. But I like the idea behind that, like going into special missions to earn unique guns, because then you won't just be spamming out guns in the construction facility. you'll have specific guns where you're like, okay, this one's good enough to use, but I don't know where to use it. I can only have one of them. So I like elements like that. A part of me feels like it may have been a mobile game, though, because there's certain elements that I'm kind of confused as to why they exist. Like, there's like references to like time all the time. Like, you have like one, it takes 1 minute and 10 seconds to get from here to there and then back to get the crystals, or it takes a certain amount of time for your bases to generate money. However, there's nothing in the actual game aside from that that requires you to be concerned about time. Like, I could sit here and just let my guys go on missions for me, or rather tell them to, have them generate resources ad nauseum until I'm ready to spend them, and then go do actual battles. So I'm not quite sure what the deal is with the clocks, but they're there, and you can actually time out how long it takes to actually get resources and then like play your strategy for like how long you, what you want to build up towards for your next gun loadout or whatever. But as you go through battles, you'll get your resources, which you'll use to just build up your base. You'll eventually unlock more areas on the map, which contain more towers and more missions that you'll take on and eventually hopefully get to the end of the game. But there's a lot of content here if you're okay with the idea of the tower defense mechanic. You can even go back to old stages and like have skirmishes. But honestly, I do like tower defense games anyway, and I did find this one to be a genuinely good time. I was confused about those, those mobile-esque mechanics, but they don't hurt the game at all. The game is fun to play.
No.
If you like the idea of like shifting like, you know, cannons around and like freaking the hell out as like dirigibles and freaking like weird like word like hurdy gurdy cars or like driving up to blow up your tower, I think it's a solid bet. It plays well. It's fun. I like the theme of it. Music, I could take it or leave it. But all in all, it's a good time.
Well, then overall, $10. Your thoughts?
I would honestly say this is also a buy. It's a unique tower defense game too, which is also worth pointing out. I can't think of too many that play like this.
Yeah, I can go with a buy it on this one. I had fun with it as well. It's tough.
Yes, it is. Yes, it freaking is.
It ramps
up quick. It ramps up fast. Get that auger.
Yeah.
The auger is so good.
All right. Anyway, next game to talk about is called Ruinverse, developed by XCreate, published by Chemco, released December 4th on Xbox One and Windows 10 for $14.99. Follow Kit, a kind-hearted transporter, and his vivacious childhood friend Allie as they team up with a third-rate swindler, a quack physician, and a ditzy dwarf to travel the world in their quest to save Allie from a plight that threatens her very existence, while experiencing their moments of triumph and hardship in what is sure to be an unforgettable journey for RPG lovers everywhere. Chris, I know you're an RPG lover, and you are everywhere, so is this true. An unforgettable journey?
No. Gosh. It's a Chemco XCreate game. Come on. I've already forgotten it. No, I'm just kidding. That would make for an awkward review. Okay, so yes, this is a, as I said, a Chemco XCreate game now. It's funny because, like, a few times in the last, like, month, I've actually had to break down, like, in many paragraphs, like, the whole Chemco RPG jam. You know, just the fact that they come out with like an RPG every month or so, pretty much on the clock or on the dot, you know, like clockwork. But they're made by different people and they're like different kinds of things. But usually people shy away from them because they see like screenshots and whatever, and they're basically seeing the same game every time. And I always tell people, well, you're probably looking at the XCreate side of things. Although I will say that Hit Point, I've now taken the Hit Point side of things, which is Legend of the Tetrarchs, Monster Viator, and Crystal Ortho, which I reviewed last time. Those all actually have started to look real similar, and so I've started taking to calling them the poncho games.
Poncho games.
Yeah, because they all have the ponchos.
They do.
Yeah, but the XCreate games do not have the ponchos. They have, like, just kind of, like, RPG enemies that you usually see in other places. So, yeah, this is the XCreate side of the glut of, you know, Chemco RPGs. This is definitely the type of game that features most heavily in their catalog. It's very 32-bit looking, you know, nice clean sprites. This one actually features a little bit of bloom lighting too, which I'm like trying to get used to. I'm just kind of like, my screen looks wet. Anyways. And yeah, this one is, you know, follows the adventure of, so Kemco X-Create games always have one of two protagonists. Okay. They're all male. They're always male. I've never seen a deviation from that. They're either unlikable jerks that are forced into situations they don't want to like deal with, but have to anyway, cause it's a video game, or they are just like, just the goodest boy. And, the goodest boy. And the protagonist of this particular game is like the goodest of the goodest boys. He is like, you know, so they've decided to like all of their games, at least the most recent ones, and actually no, going all the way back to Alphadia, so I'm just gonna say yeah, all of them feature like instant travel and warping past dungeons if you've cleared them already and things like that. Well, in this one they've actually put that, they've woven that into the lore, and so the hero here is a transporter, that is to say a person who can warp an entire party to a different part of the world if they've been there already. So like that's a special job in the story now, and so our character is unique in that. But he's also a gardener, and he is also the long suffering but, you know, always optimistic victim of abuse from his slightly older female. Always the secondary character is always female and always has a quirk, right? Like, I think we've talked about that before. Well, in this game, the entire plot is based around the quirk of this particular character. And, yeah, she is a brash and abusive person that, like, her thing is that she's always hitting this dude. And it's actually kind of not cool. But anyways, but then, after they come across a magic thing, it, you know, which is also incorporated into the story, she suddenly wakes up having like, you know, seemingly having amnesia. But what they find out is that now she has a second soul inside of her body. And that is the soul of a dude who has amnesia. So not only does she have a second person inside of her, this person doesn't even know who he is. He only knows basic stuff about his like own identity. And I thought this was going to be really problematic, but it's so couched in like that in RPG tropes that it actually really toes that line pretty well. So, you know, and the problem is that they have to kind of figure out how to get this dude out of her and into his own body, or, you know, they don't, you know, try to figure out how to get them separated, because it's possible that their souls could merge and then that would destroy both people.
Always
so good. Yeah, them's the stakes. And then of course there's a demon lord running amok. That's also a common theme in the Kemco X-Create games. And we actually get to see like bad guy scenes, very early on. So we kind of know who's doing what and what they're doing. So like the differences between this one and the other. Oh, and of course, there's the other characters who are usually pretty forgettable, but I'm going to go ahead and talk about them anyway. We get an elven doctor who is a bit of a quack and an extortionist who, kind of tags along with the, so his thing is that he always wants to examine the protagonist because due to the blushing under his eyes, I assume that he has a crush on the protag. My cat's now being very loud. So he's like always like, let me examine you and all this other stuff. And, you know, that's another trope. And but like he comes in handy because he also extorts a swindler who initially is a somebody that you're chasing after, but it's a doggy man, a very, very furry looking thing. And here's the interesting part is that there's a fifth character. You have a five character party in this game.
What? A Kemco game?
Yeah, I know. Anyways, it's either four. When it comes to X-Create, it's either 4 or 400. Like, because, you know, Alvastia Chronicles and Dragon Sinker both have, like, massive casts of, yeah, like, characters, including trees and filing cabinets. So, anyways, That's one thing I do love is how consistent they are at being ridiculous. The fifth character is a member of the Royal Guard who is a 30-something-year-old dwarf in the Lord of the Rings sense, who, of course, appears as a 12-year-old girl because 32 is very young in dwarf years, according to the game's lore. So, and she is, at first it seems she's chasing the swindler fox dog boy for crimes, what he committed. But it turns out she is just obsessed with him and like treating him like a pet. So that's also maybe not cool. But anyways, whatever. I'm actually going to send a picture of another ridiculous thing in this game. This is not related to any actual characters. This is just a character from the beginning of the game who is an alpaca llama with a super buff dude's torso. And is naked and is just a character that has no like real part in the plot. But that's just the kind of thing that's peppered into this game is
I
like,
don't know if I want to use that as the episode image.
You shouldn't, but it's in there. There's like muscle men with the faces of llamas in this game.
So would you call him a sixth alpaca, an alpaca?
Oh, a six pack alpaca.
That's right.
Oh, that joke's hard to nail.
But it's so worth trying.
I know. So that's it for the characters in the story. I don't want to go into that anymore. Let's talk about mechanics. Because that's the main difference between Kemco X-Create games, typically. So this one does not feature the items eating items system. You just purchase new items and find them in caves and whatnot. And, you know, it's like regular sword plus 16 kind of thing. And, you can gamble for better weapons. Of course, this, it's been a trend in the last several games to feature two different kinds of gambling system, and both are present here. You know, it's just basically playing the lottery to randomly draw a certain kind of weapon or a skin to a weapon, which is just a, it's kind of like how some weapons have a rune slot or something like that. And you can put a rune in it to like give it some kind of stat increase passively. Well, that's exactly what this is, but it changes the look of the item. And of course, I'm sure it can get into the ridiculous, you know, pretty easily. This one also has the gardening aspect, of course. Our hero is a gardener, so it actually does make sense in the context of this game to have that. However, the skill system is a little bit different. Instead of, you know, there are a few games that have experimented with the skill system, because normally it's just when you level up, you learn skills in a certain element or you can change your element and like learn skills that way by leveling up and whatnot. This one actually separates it into skill trees, like many other RPGs basically, but they're separated into physical arts, magical arts, and passive things basically that you can choose. And when you level up, you just straight up get points that you can then dump into the tree and like kind of customize your characters that way. I actually really like this system because it kind of keeps you from just, you know, loading up a page of like 100 different spells and then just always spamming the most powerful one. Yeah. So and the game also does feature things like HP restores completely after every battle. That's something they must have borrowed from Hit Point. However, magic does not restore. So if you are able to just, you know, pound through enemies or set auto battle to like, you know, just kind of beat enemies that are much weaker, that's fine. But yeah, if you start using magic, then you actually have to like consider your MP pool.
Unless so. You want to drop a couple of bucks on one of Kemco's famed microtransactions where
yep,
you can drop $5 for either double damage or triple experience, or you could drop $4 for no skill cost.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, and that's typical again. However, none of those are required. The game has either 4 or 5 levels of difficulty, and the easiest is very easy. So yeah. You're going to get through this game no matter what. It's just those are there to, you know, keep grinding to the absolute minimum. And you know,
for those who want it.
Exactly. That's fine. But you know, personally for this particular chapter, like usually for hit points, I actually do recommend at least the XP boost because hit point games get really difficult towards the end. Holy geez, kitty.
Meow.
He is really complaining right now. Anyways, I can like hear him in my headphones. anywho's. But in this particular game, and pretty typically in the X-Create games, they do a good enough job of keeping things like easy enough without being boring that I think that it's usually not necessary to like purchase any DLC or anything like that.
No.
But yeah.
Well, overall, $15 on Ruinverse. What do you think?
Well, if you are trying to get into Kemco X-Create games, I'd say this one kind of sits around the middle for quality. It's not super ridiculous, like, you know, Midden Wall or anything like that, but it's also not like totally bland, like one of the Alphadia games. it's ridiculous enough. I didn't find myself really liking any of the characters. So it didn't really grab me all that much. The systems, yeah, some of them, I like some improvements, but I didn't really feel like, oh, wow, they really changed the game this time. It's, you know, like the common criticism of X-Create, it does feel like more of the same for certain, like, games that they've been coming out with lately. So I'm going to put this one in the try it category. I mean, you know, there's nothing that makes this one stand head and shoulders above the rest, but it is solid and it is interesting. And, you know, mechanically, it is fun to play and keeps you coming back. So it's solid for the price, you know, but, you know, this is not the the must have of the group. So I'm just, you know, hitting it straight in the middle on try it.
Works for me. One final party cast game to talk about is called Shoot One Up DX, developed by Mommy's Best Games and Super Soul, published by Mommy's Best Games, released December 4th on Xbox One for $5.99. Why play shoot 'em ups one ship at a time? Launch them all at once. Unleash an entire armada of ships and Shoot One Up DX. We've talked about this one on the show a few times before, so we don't have to go too in-depth, but Purnell, how is it on Xbox One?
It's short but fun for what it is. No performance issues or anything like that. I did find that I was asking, now that I've asked Mel to play it myself, I saw what Cole was referring to on her review where she said, everything's like, it's like a woman, or like it's like sexualized. But I think it was only one stage. Like, I didn't see that for every stage, but it was one level where it was pretty clearly like that. It was like the level where you fought like the Lilith robot. And it was like naked women on the ground and like giant lip monsters flying around, mess like that. But other than that, I didn't catch that part. But yeah, the game is fairly straightforward. I mean, I did like the fact that you can between stages, there's always like this weird divergent path you can take where you can either like go straight ahead, just always go straight. Or you can like do something differently. Sometimes you'll fly backwards. Other times you'll go into freeform, which means that enemies are coming from all around you, and you're just kind of spinning your ship, firing bullets everywhere. I also like the idea that one trigger expands, like, you, because as the name says, every time you get a one up, the ship is present on the screen. Whenever you get hit, you can't lose more than one ship at a time, which is very nice. You can only lose one at a time, not like all five that got whacked. But I like the fact that you can use one trigger to make the ships come closer, to make it so you can maneuver more. And you can push the other trigger to make them expand, you know, spread out so that you can like ultimately just like get more bullets in more areas of the screen and ultimately also fire a giant laser. Though towards the last two or three stages, you will probably rarely, if ever, get to pull off the laser because you will be to the point where it's almost like bullet hell style. And you're trying to bring the ship together just to dodge projectiles. So you'll be using, you know, P Ship Junior. But I honestly found the game to be enjoyable. I mean, I'll openly admit, though, that there's no, like, real power-ups in the game. You basically get, like, you know, point shields. Like, you get a lot of, like, cave shooters. And you get the one-ups themselves. And there's one unique power-up, which is the Ghost, which allows you to, like, a clone of your ship to come out. And then when you, like, it's almost like Pac-Man, like that Ghost Pac-Man at Pac-Man Anniversary, where it'll be a clone of your ship on the other side of the screen. And if you move closer to the center, so will it. farther away. So it's just like another set of guns firing, except those guns can't be blown up. So, I mean, once you beat the game proper, you can unlock a score trek mode, which is just like a score challenge, like endless score challenge mode. And there's also just the heroic difficulty, which is just the harder difficulty in the game. I played it on normal and beat it that way. But honestly, I'd say the game is fairly fun. If it was more expensive, I'd say try to deny it, though, only because of how short it is. But for the price point it's at, I enjoyed my time with it. And by the time I was done, if I was a big shmup guy, by the time I've done normal and in heroic mode, I'd say it was worth $6 just to junk around with for a while.
Cool. So your official verdict at $6?
This is a hat trick, I guess, but I would say buy it here too.
Cool.
DX.
Anyone else have anything to say on Shoot 1 Up DX? I think everyone's played it.
I feel vindicated.
The Lilith Bot, I laugh. She actually has like boob rockets that she just like launches them both, and then like turds start spraying lasers. Like, what the heck is this? This is ridiculous. It's a good game.
Yeah, it's fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we get Nathan back on the show sometime soon. Was hoping to have him on this week on the show, but unfortunately things didn't work out. We're hoping maybe sometime in January, but we shall see.
Here's the hoping.
Cool. Well, that is it for y'all. Tim's going to join me to talk about a couple of more games. He didn't want to join you guys. He said something about like you smell.
She smells too by the seashell shore.
Cool. All right. Well, any final words from any of y'all before we move on?
Nah, for me, I feel like I'm trying to make myself go exercise, but I want to go to bed. So we'll see how this goes. But I think I'm solid.
Anyone else?
Nope. Bye.
All right. And finally, we are bringing in Tim Ekibis to wrap up the show. Tim, how are you doing?
Finally. This will be a great segment. My brain is totally all together. My Mondays are scrambled right now because my child is remote learning, and then like I have to go into work still.
Oh man!
So it's just like taking the thing that you stick into your cake mix, your blender, your high speed whisker sort of deal, and then you just stick that in my brain and just go. that's how I am on like Mondays and Tuesdays. It's like my brain just flippy flopping back and forth from like, oh, I need to be at home and do work and help my child do schoolwork remotely, and then I have to go to my job, and then yeah, so it's a hoot.
And now you get to talk about video games.
Yeah, video games. Yes, definitely. And yeah,
you excited for them this week? Are they any good?
Yeah, they're pretty good, or they're good if not interesting, or interesting if not good, I guess. Sure. I should say.
Should we get into them then?
I guess we should get into it. Hey, you get a PS5 yet?
No, I didn't. How's yours?
It's good. It's all good. I haven't had any problems with it. Yeah, I think I'm the only person on the crew on staff who has a PS5 at this moment. It eventually showed up.
Yeah, you're the only one with a PS5, and I'm the only one with an Xbox.
Yeah. I mean, I have an Xbox.
Oh, a Series X.
Oh, well, now you bring up those words. Yeah, no, I haven't had any. The only cumbersome thing was when I was trying to upload my Spider-Man save from the original PS4 Spider-Man. Because I did not have my PS4. I did not have said PS4 on hand to just like, oh, I'll just stick in my... Because they didn't put out the patch until like, I don't know, a week and a half until after the PS5 came out.
Mm.
So I was like, okay, well, I got to put PS4. I have to put PlayStation 4 Spider-Man, not PlayStation 5 Spider-Man. I have to put PlayStation 4 Spider-Man into my... Well, actually, I had put in the code, and I had downloaded Ultimate Edition. Then I had to put in PS4 Spider-Man, which then installed and then updated PS4 Spider-Man. So that took like an hour and a half. Then I got in there, and then I took 2 seconds uploading my save. It was real easy and painless. And then I had to go and like delete the PS4 Spider-Man and then find the PS5 Spider-Man in my library and launch that. And then I brought in my save, and it was great. And then I turned it on real quick, or then all my achievements, my trophies unlocked. That was great, all in a row, because I got a platinum in that game.
Nice.
So, So for like 10, 15 minutes, it was just nothing but trophies unlocking. Boing. And then I went in for a second. I was like, oh, cool. And now I can play the DLC that I never played. And oh, wow, this runs at 60 frames per second. And now I'm going to go play Miles Morales because I'm going to do that first. And then I'll go back to this one. But yeah, I've played all the pretty much. I haven't finished Miles Morales yet, but I played through all of Astro's Playroom, which is great. And is kind of overlooked as like a next gen game because people are just like, oh, the only next gen game is a remake of something from 2009. No, Astro's Playroom is small, but it is original and it is a charming game that does a great job of showing off the stuff that controller can do.
I hear it's a great comparison to like Nintendo Land.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a great. I mean, Nintendo Land was like a multiplayer sort of thing. I mean, I don't. It is a,
like showing off like the history of PlayStation.
Yes, stuff yes, like that. It is that. It is like if Sony made a Nintendo game, or if Nintendo made a Sony game. Yeah, because there's like little Astrobots all over the place that will be like acting out scenes from old PlayStation game, or not just old Sony games, but like games you associate with the PlayStation, like Resident Evil and Silent Hill. Demon's Souls is there. That is a Sony game. Whatever, but it is only on Sony consoles. But yeah, stuff like that, like Symphony of the Night is on there, even though, you know, but you know, like things you associate with the PlayStation experience. And You get to there's stuff to unlock where you can look at all like the old accessories and crap and get some nostalgia for Sony. And it's like, oh, yeah, you guys have done like a lot of stuff in 25 years. OK, all right. This is neat. And it's a fun game besides that. It's just like a fun little platformer. It's a hoot.
I'll be honest. That and Sackboy are the two big things I really want with a PS5.
Yeah, I haven't looked at Sackboy at all, but I've never liked Little Big Planet that much, so meh. And I played all the way through Bugsnax, the PlayStation 5 freebie, launch day freebie, so that was cool. That was fun. My child really enjoyed it. Yeah, finished Demon's Souls, working on Miles. Immediately after I finished Demon's Souls, I started playing Dark Souls Remastered, because that's the kind of fucking nutcase I am. Well, it's kind of okay.
Sadist, so you are.
Well, it's like, so I finished Demon's Souls, I start playing Dark Souls, I was playing Blasphemous on my Switch, and then I was also reviewing this other game with some Souls DNA in it.
Should we talk about it?
It makes sense. Or we can just let that prime segue just fall to the ground.
Yeah, we'll just talk about Friday the 13th instead.
Fake in the sun, yeah.
Nah, let's get into this. The next game to talk about is called Morbid, The Seven Acolytes, developed by Still Running, published by Merge Games. It released December 3rd on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $24.99. Morbid, The Seven Acolytes is a horror punk action RPG filled with Lovecraftian horrors and Cronenbergian gore, making it the most gruesome take on the isometric Souls-like genre yet.
Jesus fucking Christ. Sorry, all the buzzwords in that goddamn copy. Come on, guys.
Well, tell us about the game.
Oh, I will. I don't really know. I guess I do see where the Souls-like comparison for me, it comes a bit more in its like tone and kind of some of the mechanics of the combat, but not so much the like when you die, you're not like leaving a puddle of your shit out in the world that you have to go back and reclaim. Like you keep all your stuff. Like I could not actually figure out what the penalty for dying was while I was playing it, which is a good thing. I don't know. It's a bad thing if there is a penalty and I couldn't figure it out. It is a good thing if there is not really a big penalty, because that makes it easier for people to get into this game.
Mm-hmm. Accessibility is good.
Accessibility is good. And yeah, I don't think people should be scared away by the Souls-like monitor that they put in there, that Pavlovian bell that they put in there to try to attract nutcases like me to play their game. So yeah, it is a top-down adventure RPG type deal where it's, you know, it's one of those games where it's not entirely an RPG, and it's like Zelda, you know, in that Zelda vein where, like, you know, back in the day it would sometimes get lumped in as an RPG and I would make a funny face and be like, what the fuck are you talking about? I don't really feel like it's more got some more RPG bits than Zelda, but it's definitely not as heavily involved in like the the weeds of min-maxing and stats and all that RPG bullshit. You end up on this island sort of deal. You come up on a beach, your character does, and you go a wandering. You have to go and kill the eponymous seven acolytes for vaguely described reasons. You pick up bits of lore in a very Souls-like fashion as you go around the island. People will drop. Excuse me. My goodness. You'll run into NPCs who will give you cryptic hints, items and shit. All have lore attached to them that you can read to try to piece things together, like the nature of this world and why things the way they are and why they are so dire and depressing. So you start out with a sword. How original. You start out with a sword, and you have like a light attack. You have a heavier attack, which are placed on opposite ends of. If I remember correctly, this game doesn't let you map buttons, which is always a pet peeve of mine. But they're on like opposite buttons. It's like X and B or something like that. They're not right next to each other. I kept like hitting Y to do my heavy attack, but that is where your gun is, because you also have a gun that is your ranged weapon, which takes bullets in order to shoot. It doesn't just have infinite bullets. And then you have like you hold down your B button or to run, or maybe it's the A button. That button, the bottom one on the diamond. Damn.
That is A on Xbox.
That is A on Xbox, yes. And that is what I played it on. So that's what I'm trying to sort. You hold down A to run, or if you tap it, you will do a dodge roll. You will do a lot of running in this game because at the basic walk speed, your character is slow as shit. Oh my god. So slow. And even when you're running, you don't even feel like you're going that fast. Like, feels like you'd be going... I'm not saying you should be going your... run speed when you're just walking, but you should definitely be going a bit faster when you're walking and a bit faster when you're running as well. And when you're running, you know, that drains your big green souls like stamina bar, and so it's just like this. It's just like, god damn, motherfucker. And I'm like playing Demon Souls, and like when you're moving around in that game, like you're moving at like a good trot, like unless you're inching your analog stick, you know, to walk or sneak or something like that. Oh, and there is a sneak button actually in this game that will make you move even fucking slower. That is like possibly my biggest complaint about this game. It's like, I just wish your character moved faster, because man, you move so goddamn slow in this game. It is ridiculous. But it's not the end of the world. So you get into combat and you have this light slash and this heavy slash, and this is where you kind of feel a bit of the cadence of the Souls games, or at least I did, and that you have to kind of time your it's deliberate is the word to use, where it's like, okay, I have to time my weapon swing, because once I start it, there's no stopping it. And I'm using that same strategy of like trying to time my heavy swing so that it lands as the enemy character is walking up on me. Or it's like I will run up on a character, do my heavy swing, and then I will dodge roll away. Very Souls-like in that sense. There's also a parry, which I didn't really use. I just rolled away. Also, at least for me, that is a very Souls-like thing to do, though I know a lot of people parry a lot more in Souls. But yeah, those are kind of your combat options. I'm trying to think if I'm forgetting one. No. So as you go around and you kill shit and you muck about the world, you will find items. You will find a bunch of different weapons. Different weapons have different properties in terms of their stats and in terms of like how they operate when you wield them. Again, very Souls-like. You like how I started this? Are you saying it's not that Souls-like, but then I'm using it as much as possible?
Yes.
But, some are faster and do different types of damage. There's fire damage and electric damage, and some things cause bleed and whatever. I was opting more towards the big, it's so one of the, inventory is a weird thing in this game, because it doesn't seem like it's quite loot-driven, per se, though enemies will randomly drop things, and you can find multiple, like, there isn't necessarily, like, one instance of a weapon. You can find weapons multiple times. You can have two different weapon sets equipped, like, you can have a melee weapon and a different gun equipped that you can switch between. Not really quick and easily. You have to, like, pop in the menu and then hit the button to switch between them, but it's there. So it's like you can get multiples of a weapon, and you will pick up loot. And the way your inventory is arranged in kind of that, like, Diablo / Resident Evil 4 style of inventory, where it's a grid and different things take up a different amount of space.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it's kind of fucked because you, as near as I could tell, you cannot rotate things. Like, you cannot rotate a weapon horizontally. They are all vertical only, which makes it tough when you're trying to puzzle piece them around and fit them in there. But also, it's like, you know, a few hours into the game, you're going to fill up your inventory, and the game did not that was not, like, there was no, like, store box to, like, put my shit in. And you don't have to be, like, a hoarder in this game. It's like, well, obviously I'm not going to use these tridents. Like, I'm holding onto it for some reason, even though I think they suck and I'm not going to use them. So I'm just going to throw them here on the ground. But it's just one of those things where it's just like, you just never know. And it seems like that would have been a real smart thing to put in there at, like, the monument things that act as souls like bonfires in this game. That seems like a good thing to be there. Like, oh, here's a bottomless box, and here you can just throw excess stuff in there. Seems like inventory management could be a real problem, or you're just going to come to a point where you're just like, you kind of realize that you just don't need all of the stuff, and you just throw the stuff in the ground that you don't need and then go about your day. So you don't really upgrade your character. Like, upgrades work in, like, two ways. So you will find, like, runes around the world, which you can attach to a weapon. Just smack them on there, which is, again, it's kind of a thing that makes me anxious, because, like, do I want to start, like, slapping runes on this weapon that I have that I'm using to make it stronger? Like, what if I find a better weapon around, like, the next corner, you know? So that made me a little apprehensive, especially because I'm like, you know, I don't want to waste all my runes on this weapon. And then, like, later on, I find better runes or a better weapon. And I was like, crap, I wish I had this rune on this weapon. They do give you a thing to scrape runes off of your weapons, to open up the holes, as it were, which are single use items. I'll get to it in a second. The other thing they let you do is you can equip abilities on yourself. I don't know, they have some kind of cryptic name to them. But, like, very suddenly, it will give you, like, so this is what it is. You start the game, and as you kill things, you're earning skill points. And for the longest goddamn time, I was like, how the hell do I spend these skill points? Like, there's nothing at this monument thing for, like, a skill tree or whatever. Like, did I miss something? Was there, like, a fucking NPC that I ran past that I was supposed to talk to? Like, what am I missing? And all of a sudden the game is like, oh, here's all the stuff you can spend your skill points on, motherfucker. Like, here all at once. So it just gives you things that you can attach. That's like, oh, here's more health, or, you have better stamina regen, or a larger stamina bar, or dodging uses less stamina, or stuff like that. And then you can pour skill points into those. Which was presented awkwardly, because it was like, oh, okay, can you skill? Like, the game is not big on tooltips or, like, any kind of tutorials or, like, just explaining anything to you. And, like, even, you know, having just played through Demon Souls and just played through Dark Souls, or playing through Dark Souls, like, as much shit as people give those games for obfuscating information, like, they teach you the basic stuff. If not in, you know, like, messages on the ground, but just on, like, leading you in the right direction, so that you know what's going on. Like, as soon as you land in the Nexus in Demon Souls, like, stockpile fucking Thomas is sitting right there with his goddamn dopey looking mustache, ready to be like, oh, I'll watch your stuff for you, cause I don't know where my family is. and then it's like, oh, here's the thing where I can put my family, and sitting right next to him is the blacksmith who will upgrade your weapons. It's like, oh, okay, I get it. Like, you can piece these things together, and, like, here's the Maiden Black who does your upgrades. Like you get a picture of like kind of what the systems are in the world and how they're going to go together and like how to spend your stuff. And this game, like, it doesn't have that in a very, I think, conducive way to the player, which can be overcome, but is kind of frustrating. Like, I just wish they had a little bit more information there for figuring out this stuff. Cause I like very quickly kind of accidentally like blew skill points that I did not realize I was blowing. Just because of the way that menu is formatted. And like, once it happened, I kind of like sat there and thought about it and looked at it, and I was like, oh, this is what's going on, where it's like, oh, you push a button to spend a skill point, and there's no kind of confirmation in there. And like, if you slap that button twice, you have spent one and then two skill points on an item, and it like very quickly, and it's like, oh shit, like what is going on here? So it just kind of like got away from me a little bit there. Which was, I mean, it was kind of like, whatever, well, I wanted to power these things up anyway, and like skill points come in at a decent clip. It's fine. It's just like, I wish it had just been a little bit better explained. To the game's credit, they do track your side quests. You can check in on your side quests at said monument. You can also, there is fast travel, but it's super fucking limited. Like, I thought initially it was going to be like, oh, every one of these things that I find, I can just travel between them, lickety-split. That's so useful for me going back to do side quests. But it's like, no, not really. Like, I probably tromped through, like, four or five, six different areas, and I'm, like, looking at my fast travel points, and it's, like, two. It's the first two areas I could travel back to. And I'm like, well, that's not very good. That's not very helpful. And it's not helped by the fact that this game doesn't have a map. And a lot of Souls-like games get away with that, because you can just kind of, you get a good feel for the world and the landmarks and how the world interconnects. And I did not get that at all out of this game. And I think back to like Blasphemous and Salt and Sanctuary, which were Metroidvania style, but they both had maps, like just unabashed, like we got maps, so you know where you're going. And this game, I felt, it doesn't even need like a super like room specific map, but just like a general, like these are the areas that you have gone through sort of map. And this is how they are, you know, arranged in the world, just to give me a sense of where I am, where I'm going. Like if I need to backtrack for a side quest, like where I should even start to travel.
No,
because I was just like, at a certain point, I'm just like, I'm getting these cycles. I'm like, I don't want to fucking start wandering. Like, I think I know where this is, but I don't quite remember the name of that area that I was in 45 minutes ago, you know, and I don't especially feel like tromping back through, even though, you know, the areas have ways to open shortcuts. I don't especially feel like tromp is stomping all the way back through them to figure out whether I'm right or wrong. And that was kind of a bother. But so there's things in this game that are quite a bother to me. Like it just feels like maybe there was like a level of like UI or, you know, gameplay tooltip polish that it just needed to like push it to another level to like really make it like this solid, cohesive, like more playable experience. But the experience that is there is not bad. In fact, it's like, you know, it's pretty interesting. Like they have some really cool ideas going on. Like I don't think I have played a Souls-like that kind of takes this overhead Zelda tack to it. I think the art is really good. I think the music is really good. Like I'm not going to jam out to it in my car, but it sets a fucking excellent tone for the game. So the game just has a great mood overall. It's just kind of like a little frustrating to play, but not in like the Souls way that I like, but in just kind of like, you're like almost there. I just wish you did a few more things, but like, I didn't find it to be like overly difficult. Again, like I didn't find it to be like punishing in a way that, you know, I feel like a lot of people are turned off from when they see Souls, like they're, oh God, it's some fucking stupid masochists who hate themselves and everyone around them. It's like, no, when you die in this game, like you keep your skill points, you don't lose them. Maybe you lose your progress to your next skill point. Huh? That's what Sekiro did. Maybe I wouldn't, that might be the thing I wasn't noticing, but either way, it's not like you lose like all of your currency or your, Oh, this game also has a sanity meter. I did not let that get high enough to figure out exactly how that was going to punish me for existing, but it's there. Shit, I lost my train of thought. Yeah, so, like, you know, you don't have that, like, feeling of, like, oh, no, I got killed way far afield from, you know, a save point. I need to, you know, I'm going to lose all my progress, or that feeling of, like, I'm going to lose all my progress. Like, that's not there. It's just kind of like you die and you go back to a checkpoint, and it's not that bad. So I think it is something that, you know, people that aren't necessarily interested in Souls might want to take more of a look at as just like a cool overhead exploration, action, adventure, RPG, whatever the fuck you want to call it, sort of deal. And that Souls people might want to take a look at for, while not being like super tight in the mechanics and in some other ways, it definitely does strike the mood of a Souls game. So I think it has like a more broad appeal, but not as strong an appeal as some other games that fall under this subgenre. That makes sense.
Overall, $25. What do you think about it?
I think it is a solid and earnest try it. Like, it's not everybody's going to love it, but I think more people should be interested in checking it out than might think otherwise. Like, I think it has a potential broader appeal than you might think. But like, some of the rough edges make it tough to just like do an outright recommendation to kind of either crowd. But I think it's really cool.
Nice. It sounds cool. For people who are interested, at least on Xbox, it is on sale for $19.99 for the next 2 weeks. So you could check it out there.
You could
save a couple of bucks,
$5.
Anyway, final game to talk about tonight is called Friday the 13th Killer Puzzle, developed and published by Blue Wizard Digital, released November 13th on PS4 for $12.99. Become horror icon Jason Voorhees and stalk campers across 150-plus levels in the most gruesome puzzle game ever. Solve murder-licious puzzles to rank up and unlock new weapons and special attacks. Help Jason terrorize victims from the campgrounds of Crystal Lake to the high-rises of Manhattan, from Supermax prisons to space stations and beyond. Tim, tell us about Friday the 13th Killer Puzzle.
It's the last review, because it's going to kill us and end this episode at the end. If things go well, if whoever's controlling Jason, you know, solves the puzzle correctly. What the hell was I gonna say? Friday the 13th, The Killer Puzzle. This game has existed on phones for a while, which you can, I bring this up whenever if there's a phone game port. It's like, oh, you can tell, you can see the DNA. But here it is, and we're just gonna assume that if you're this far into the show and you're listening to this review, you are, like, interested in playing this game on a TV and not your phone. So it is a great use of the Friday the 13th franchise. It is a puzzle game where you are. So you have Jason and you have a isometric grid, and you push a direction and Jason moves straight in a straight line in that direction. All right. And your object on most given levels is to kill everyone that is not Jason in the level. There's sometimes when there's like security guards or like other people you can just kind of avoid. And your job is to kill. Sometimes you have specific objectives as to who you need to kill. And you don't need to kill everybody. So that's it. So like, OK, I move Jason in this direction, this direction, this direction. You move him in a pattern around the grid to have him kill everybody. And that's it. Easy peasy. You move on to the next level. And that's all. Yeah, there's no other obstacles for 180 levels. Lol. No. So the things they'll put in your way, there are as much of an indestructible death machine that Jason Voorhees is. He does have a few weaknesses and probably a few extra weaknesses for the sake of making this a compelling video game. But of course, like, you can't fall into water as Jason. Jason is weak against water. He drowned in Camp Crystal Lake as a child while his camp counselors were fucking. And that's his whole origin story. Doesn't do well in water. Can't swim. So if you go in a direction and that puts you into water, you die. I'm surprised he can't walk through fire, but he can't do that either. There are guards that will, like, shoot him or kill him. There are hazards basically that will kill your ass dead. So you have to be mindful when you're moving around these areas. That's where the puzzle aspect comes in, because sometimes the most obvious route, because you are limited, like you can't move Jason just one space. He moves until he runs into something.
It's like sliding on ice blocks in a platform game. It
is exactly like a sliding on ice block puzzle. Basically, that is what's going on. But we don't want to say ice block puzzles because everybody hates ice levels. So forget we said that. Redacted. It's a fun, simple thing where you can sit down and like blow through a bunch of levels, or maybe not blow through a bunch of levels if you're stumped. But if you can't, hey, guess who's there to help you? It's Jason Voorhees' mom. She is there she is your like narrator, tutorial voice, there to root on her baby boy as he moves around and slaughters all these people. And if needed, she'll give you a hint, or she'll just let you skip the puzzle if it's too tough for her little guy. You know, one might see on a phone game where that might be where they riddle in some microtransactions where it's like, oh, you need to pay for a certain amount of skips or wait a certain amount of time. But on the PS4, don't worry about that shit. don't got to. So as you go, there are different biomes, different themed levels. You will unlock different costumes for Jason as you go around. The game is not taking itself seriously. Like, this is a ridiculous application of an R-rated murder violence, franchise. Like, they know what they're doing here. It's ridiculous. You go into the pause menu and there is an option just to make the game go ch-ch-ch. Like, it's just there on demand whenever you want it. You know, it's just right there. It's just right there. And why wouldn't you do it all the time or, you know, whatever. It has a marathon just outside of the main, block of fucking like, nearly 200 puzzles. There's also a marathon mode. There's a daily puzzle on there with like leaderboards. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. It's pretty fun. It does what it sets out to do, I think, very well.
Yeah, I know Cole liked this one when she covered it on Xbox. It sounds like you had a good time with it on PS4. So for $13, what is your verdict?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely worth buying, for sure.
Cool.
Yeah, if you're looking for a puzzler or, you're into Friday the 13th, and certainly if those two interests intersect.
And we made it through and we're not dead.
Yet.
Ch-ch-ch. We'll be right back.